Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Why do we sometimes not do the thing we know that works or works better? We've all probably had instances in our life where we knew there's a better way to achieve our goal or achieve success, but we don't do it. Why? Why is that? Well, that's one of the many questions my guest today has explored in his writing career. His name is Malcolm Gladwell. Many of you have probably read some of his books like Outliers or Tipping Point or David and Goliath. Malcolm's got a new podcast out called Revisionist History, where he goes back in history to uncover overlooked or misinterpreted stories and pulls insights from them so we can apply them to our lives today, or at least think about them. Today on the show, Malcolm and I discuss how Wilt Chamberlain found a better way to shoot free throws that increased his free throw percentage rate considerably, but he purposely decided to stop doing it, and what we can learn from him on avoiding that mistake. We also discuss the art of finding insightful stories in the mundane, asking good questions, and why you might want to decline that acceptance to a prestigious university. Lots of stuff to chew on in this podcast. After you're done, check out the show notes at aom.is/Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on it.
Well, I've long been a fan of your work, and I'm enjoying your new podcast, Revisionist History, and we'll talk about that today because you've got some great topics you're delving into. But I'd like to get meta first because I've been curious about this. You've made a career out of taking what seems on the surface very mundane or obscure stories. You've written about infomercials or ketchup, but then you show how they can provide insights into complex problems that cut across domains. I'm curious, what's your process of going about that? I mean, it seems like it requires a lot of curiosity. So how did you develop that curiosity?
Oh, you know, I never know how to answer that question. I'm a little bit of a magpie, so I collect ideas and quirky stories and things and puzzle over them for a long time to figure out how they could be useful. So a lot of it is just I have a big random group of things that I'm always looking to find a home for. Also, I don't know, I think I'm because I'm not an expert in anything, I move horizontally through ideas, not vertically. So I never, you know, if you think about it, I've never written a book or even an article that was almost never, that was solely about one thing. I don't go deep, I go wide. So I'm as puzzled and by people who go deep as people who go deep are puzzled by me who goes wide. You know, when I look at someone who writes an entire book about a single subject and goes into fascinating detail, I always wonder how on earth did they do that? You know, it's just
right.
Not my,
like about the toothpick or something like that.
Yeah, not my way of thinking about the world.
And it seems like it requires asking good questions. And one thing I remember in how what the dog saw, you talked about there's certain people you want to ask questions, like the higher ups. People at the top of the chain aren't usually the ones you want to ask questions. It's in the middle. Why are people who are in the middle or, you know, down on the, who are actually doing the work, the best people to ask questions?
Yeah. Well, because they're seeing things from a different perspective, and they are freed of certain kinds of constraints. So to give you an example, there was a report that came out from the RAND Corporation some months ago that was talking about how the staff at the SEC had increased dramatically in size over the last couple of years. And at the RAND's having a conference, and I told them I would do a Q&A at the conference about this report, because I think it's really interesting. What happens to decision-making when there's more people in the room? And the question came up, well, who should we do the Q&A with? Do we want to get, you know, someone way, way high at the NSC? Or do you want to get someone in the middle? And my sentence was, actually, you want the person in the middle, because they actually see that. We want to get into the nitty-gritty of what happens when you make crucial time limit decisions with 50 people, and before you used to do it with 6, right? And I want to know what that feels like. I don't know, is that good? Is it bad? Is it, you know, I want really mundane things. Like, is it harder to schedule a meeting when you've got 50 in the room? Like, does that mean you can't have the meeting as quickly? Is it harder or less hard to reach consensus? Is it, you know, you're not actually interested, and probably they couldn't tell you what the subject of the meeting was, right? So anyway, yeah, I don't really care about the subject. What I want to know is just what happens to people when they're in a different sort of context. And the person who can answer that question, I almost want to go as low as I can. I almost want the person sitting in the corner who didn't say anything at all, just was taking notes. You know, someone's assistant. I don't know if we can get that low, but the person who led the meeting has a completely different, you know, they're thinking about the politics of it, who they have to report to, the sensitivity, the material. They're not who we want in this instance. Right. Now, maybe if I'm a national security reporter for the New York Times, I do want that person because my goal is to find out what came out of the meeting, what the decision was. But I'm not interested, you know, my perception is different. I'm interested in, it's not what has drawn me to this example. So it's just a kind of, it just depends what questions you're asking. And because I'm very interested in process questions, it means I'm very often not interested in the person at the top.
Gotcha.
Anyway.
So another thing I think you're really good at is taking really complex ideas and simplifying them for just regular folks to understand. And I think that's actually a really important skill for people to develop because our society, economy is becoming more and more complex. So I'm curious, do you have a process that you go through to simplify complex ideas?
Well, no, but it was very much a part of my kind of upbringing. You know, my mother is someone who's one of the things, a writer, and writes in an incredibly clear and transparent way. And I remember as a child being very kind of taken by how clear her writing was. This is a model for me. And then my father is a mathematician from talking to people in his field, I came to understand that he was someone who was, whose kind of specialty was, he would take the 10-page proof and turn it into a 2-page proof. So I sort of feel it's in my blood somehow to want to, and he was also, he would teach me math as a child and would take something I was hopelessly befuddled about and resolve it and explain it in an incredibly elegant, simple way. And so I think I just sort of came to think of that as the highest form of communication, you know, and I remember even as a small boy, I was like, you know, like many boys, endlessly played board games or card games, and I would always insist on being the one who explained the game to everyone else if they hadn't played it before. because I was always convinced I could explain it better than anybody else, and I could even explain it better than the instructions. I always found instructions lacking. you know how you get a new board game when you're like 8 years old and you read the instructions and then it makes no sense?
Right.
This would infuriate me. The way they were written would infuriate me. I would always have my own way of kind of explaining how they worked.
Right. And then again, this is your focus on processes again that you have that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. 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 No, even the very simple thing, instructions on games, the first thing you should say is what the point of the game is, right? What is winning in this game? And they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't say, the first line should be, you know, in Monopoly, the winner is the person who, dot, dot, dot. And then explain the rules, right? But they would always, somehow they would feel like the point of the game is supposed to kind of emerge from an understanding of the rules, which strikes me as crazy, completely backwards. So that was I guess I've been doing this all my life.
Doing your entire life. It's really interesting. So let's talk about some of the things you've written about and what you're doing on your podcast now. And as mm-hmm. I read your work and as I've been listening to your podcast, Revisionist History, it seems like a common idea that you explore is why people, you know, they'll know what they need to do, that there's a better way to do something, but they don't do it. And you explore this idea that I thought was completely fascinating in your podcast about the granny shot in basketball.
Yeah.
Can you talk about like what we can learn about why humans sort of self-sabotage themselves from Wilt Chamberlain and the granny shot?
Yeah, that's the first episode. It's funny, you know, I didn't think that was one of the stronger episodes, and yet it seems to be the one that listeners have gravitated to the most, which just shows you what a bad judge you are of one's own work. But that, I was reading, I can't remember why, I was really an interesting book on Wilt Chamberlain, and it just describes his greatest game, his 100-point game in 1962, I think, when it's still the greatest basketball game anyone's ever played. And he shot 28 for 32 from the line, and which is weird because he was famously a terrible free throw shooter. So then you keep reading and you realize, oh, wait, that season was one of the only seasons in his career where he consistently shot underhanded because his team had brought in one of the famous old school, actually a guy from the, what was it called? I think the Hebrew League. So the Jewish Basketball League of Philadelphia, a guy named Cy Castleman, famous free throw shooter, who shot underhanded, was brought in to teach Wilt Chamberlain this way of shooting. And all of a sudden, Wilt Chamberlain becomes a fantastic free throw shooter. And then the first thing he does after becoming a fantastic free throw shooter is go back to shooting the old way, so he could be a terrible one again. Which struck me as being so bizarre that I thought, but more than just bizarre, so typical of human beings that we don't always do the thing that's right or correct for us or best. We're very often quite happy to go back and do the thing that got us into trouble, right? I mean, there's a million examples. People who have a problem with alcohol relapse. We all have bad habits. We know they're bad and we persist in doing them. And so I thought it would be really interesting to kind of use the free throw story as a way of talking about that very human tendency to behave stupidly even when we know better. So, you know, it's distinct from we do stupid things all the time just because we don't know better, but we also do stupid things when we do know better. So I wanted that second case. What made the show work, I think, is that I went and interviewed Rick Barry, who was one of the few basketball players to ever consistently use the underhanded free throw. And even he would do it, you know, even though he was sort of not reviled, but made fun of for using this kind of awkward shot. And he turns out to be this incredibly compelling character. And so that the episode is just all about Wilt Chamberlain and Rick Barry, and then trying to make sense of why is it that some people can do some kind of be one of the few to be willing to try some new idea, and the rest of us are hostile.
Right, and you talk about, you get into that whole idea in sociology of thresholds, where
yes,
some of us need that, a lot of people to be doing something before we're like, yeah, I'll do that too.
Yeah, if you think about it as a kind of peer pressure model, that some people, all of us will do even the most ridiculous thing if enough people are also doing the ridiculous thing, right? I mean, so there's, but some people don't require a lot to go first before they act. And that difference in how many people, how many of your peers need to be doing something before you'll join in is called your threshold. And low threshold people don't need a lot of others to go first. And high threshold people need the world to go first before they'll join in. Wilt Chamberlain was a high threshold person. He was not going to continue shooting the underhanded free throw if he was going to be the only one or one of the only people. He didn't want to be, didn't want to stand out in that way. Whereas Rick Barry is someone who is quite happy being the only person in the NBA to shoot that way. It doesn't bother him. That he's that kind of, throughout his whole career, he persisted in doing things that sort of set him apart from others. And that's a kind of, that way of understanding our behavior is really interesting because it frames our choices in social terms. It says the reason you do certain things may have nothing to do with the quality of the idea or your own personal preferences. It just has to do with the social context. You know, that your 12-year-old, your 18-year-old son will drive 100 miles an hour while drunk, even though he knows that is a terrible idea, if he's in a car full of his friends who are all drunk and urging him to drive 100 miles an hour, right? It's just social. He don't want to do it. He doesn't believe in that. He's a lot smarter than that. But in the moment, surrounded by his peers egging him on, he's capable of doing something very stupid. That is a profoundly human reaction.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had to cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned this bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box. And I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chop sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Well, I'm curious, in your research, have you found anything where you can sort of inculcate, sort of an antidote to that, where you can actually raise your threshold to where you'll just do something even if other people are saying, don't do that or do this?
Well, there's a great example of this in binge drinking on campus. This is one of the single most effective interventions against drinking on campus. They asked students what percentage of students they thought engaged in binge drinking. And most students said they thought it was something like 60% or 70% of a lot of students. So they thought that binge drinking was something the majority did. And so that's why they did it. They felt they were, to not binge drink would be to stand out. And then they informed them that the real number is actually something like 20%. It's a minority. And just telling students that something they thought was something everyone did was actually something that very few people did dramatically reduced the incidence of binge drinking. So there what you're doing is you're playing with thresholds. You're saying that a behavior that people thought was commonplace was actually rare. And the minute you say that a behavior is rare, the social context in which that behavior occurs changes dramatically.
I think I've heard a similar study with that with hookup culture where they'll ask students like, how many of your peers do you think are engaging in, sexual relationships like on the first date? And everyone thought everyone was doing it, but then they informed them, no, it's actually a small percentage. And then that reduced the amount.
Yeah, it's the same. It's a remarkably effective way of, same thing happened. If you think about something simple like, wearing your seatbelt, Americans were resistant for years to wearing their seatbelts. But now it's second nature. If you don't wear your seatbelt, you stand out so much that it's almost impossible not to buckle up. And can you imagine? I can't remember being in a car where someone wasn't wearing a seatbelt. I mean, it would be, everyone would remark on it. They would think you were weird and strange. I mean, the kind of social pressure now around wearing a seatbelt is overwhelming. That was not true in 1980.
Yeah. And I think you explore this idea of like people knowing what they should do. There's a better way to do something, but they don't do it. You also hit on this a bit in David and Goliath, where you talk about, again, basketball, but this team of 12-year-old girls who were utilizing the full court press all the time to win basketball games. That seems to be related to that, because like no one else does it, but this one team decided that this is what they're going to do.
Yeah. Well, you don't. Basketball teams, particularly youth girls basketball teams, don't play that way because it's obnoxious. If you press against a group of 12-year-old girls, they won't be able to get the ball off the court. I mean, and so that you can't actually play basketball if you press 100% of the time against, non-elite, even boys basketball at that age. The game becomes impossible to play. So you have to be willing to disrupt the game in a really profound way, to play that way, right? You have to be pretty bold and thick-skinned, because the other team, the other parents particularly, are going to get really angry because no one's shooting. It's just all turnovers. So that was a sort of funny thing. It was that, this is not a strategy that, it's a strategy that requires, at least in the beginning, some pretty thick-skinned, obnoxious people to pull off.
Right. And you talk about Rick Barry was sort of thick-skinned and obnoxious. He didn't have a really good reputation. Even you talked about in his biography, like he had these quotes from his parents who just like kind of, eviscerated him a little bit, and that he was okay with that.
Yeah, he didn't care what people think about him. I think he's a very pleasant, I actually think he thought he was a nice, good person, but he just doesn't, the rest of us spend a lot of time doing things and saying things that we think will win the approval of those around us. He does not. It's not even on the table. He does what he thinks is right. And that is a really, that's a sure way to make enemies. He went on and on about how, and he's absolutely right, he does not understand why in the NBA, when someone misses a free throw, all the members of his team congratulate him. He's like, why are you congratulating? The guy just blew it. He just botched an incredibly important and straightforward basketball play, and you're reinforcing his mistake by clapping him on the back and high-fiving him and doing whatever you do. He's like, that's crazy. You should be doing the opposite. You should be shaming this guy for missing the free throw. He's right. I mean, why are you congratulating someone for screwing up? You're creating a social context in which people don't feel they have to be great free throw shooters, right?
Right.
But you can see why someone who feels that way would be ostracized on a basketball team.
Yeah.
That Rick Barry would be the guy glaring at.
Yeah, it's all social.
At Dwight Howard for missing a free throw in the final minute of the game.
Right.
And that's not going to endear you to Dwight Howard.
Well, Malcolm, one something I've noticed, you're very passionate about education, particularly education philanthropy. Because I saw the tweet storm that you did a while back ago. And I have two questions related to education, because I think they're connected in a way. In David and Goliath, you talk about how the way many college students go about deciding which college to attend actually can stunt their academic growth. Can you flesh that idea out a bit?
Yeah, that's called Big Fish, Little Pond Theory. And it says that it just is a psychological observation that it's really hard to be in the bottom half of any classroom. It really makes it difficult for you to remain confident, to learn what you need to learn, to persevere. And there's all kinds of evidence for this. And so putting a student in a situation where he or she is in the bottom half is perilous. It's not always bad. It just increases the chances that particularly if you're engaged in something that's very difficult, that you're going to drop out. So I'd use the example of science and math classes. It's really hard to be in the bottom half of a difficult math class. And when we look at why dropout rates are so high in science and math education, and they are extremely high, that's what's happening, is that if you're taking calculus and you're the worst person, you're the worst student in the class, chances of you finishing the year in that class are just minimal. And so what that says is that the best place, the best environment to be when you're looking for a college is not the most elite college you can get into, but the college that where your chances of being in the top half are greatest. So the best college for you is not the best college you can get into.
Right. So if there's a choice between an Ivy League school and a state school, go with the state school.
Sometimes.
You're right.
Many people will be better off in the state school because you'll be in a situation where you feel much more confident. And so your chances of getting a science degree or a law degree or a medical degree or what have you may be much greater in a non-elite place than an elite place. That consideration, that simple rule, I think is very often ignored. And students are so obsessed with the kind of getting into the most prestigious school they can that they forget that the most prestigious school may not be the best school for you.
Right. And haven't they done studies where they found that, looking at long-term trends, I know they've done this with law school, at least, that, which school you attended overall doesn't affect how well you do as a lawyer later on. You could go to a state school and you've done just as well financially as a kid who went to Harvard.
Yeah, generally speaking, when economists do very careful studies of the usefulness of an elite education, what they discover is it's not as useful as you think. So that it's really people from Harvard do well because the kind of person who goes to Harvard does well in the world. They would do just as well if they didn't. It's not Harvard, in other words, it's making them succeed in life. It's the fact that they're a very, very smart, talented person. And so it's their personal characteristics, not the characteristics of their school, that are predictive of their success. So once you account for that, you realize the additional advantage that accrues from the reputation of your undergraduate school is small. It's just, we exaggerate it. It's just not the case that it makes a huge amount of difference where you go.
It just makes you feel good in the moment saying that I got accepted to Brown. And that's where I'm going to go.
Yeah.
So I think this idea is connected to a recent podcast episode you did on revisionist history. This idea that going with the most prestigious school can backfire on a person individually. It also seems it's connected to your idea of how education philanthropy is done. So in the past 20 years, there's been a boom in donations to American universities, big donations. But you argue that the way it's done is actually not all that productive. Why is that?
Well, there has been this dramatic uptick in large gifts, so $100 million plus gifts to American institutions, college institutions. They have all overwhelmingly gone to schools that are already rich. So, the last $400 million donations in the world of higher ed, Phil Knight's gift to Stanford and John Paulson's gift to Harvard went to schools with an endowment of $22 billion and $36 billion, respectively. People are giving lots of money to schools that already have lots of money. And that episode of revisionist history said, first of all, why? That's kind of crazy. What sense does it make to give money to people who are already rich, to institutions that are already rich? It would be like me writing a check to Bill Gates. Why would I do that? And the second point, sort of the broader point, is that when we give money away, we usually do a kind of return on our investment calculation, right? We say, how much good can be purchased with my money? And my argument is that if you give $400 million to a school that already has $36 billion, there's not much more they can do with that money. You know, they've already, presumably, if you have that much money in the bank, they're already doing the kinds of things that money can buy. You know, they've already set up the lab. They've already funded the research. They've already supported the student in financial aid. You know, whereas if you give that $400 million to a school that has $100 million in the bank, there's an amazing amount they can do with that money. They can, so it's, you know, when you, your return on your investment when you give money to a needy school is just vastly greater than if you give money to a wealthy school, just as it would be in real life if you're giving money away. The person living at the poverty line can do an extraordinary amount with $1,000. $1,000 given to a billionaire is meaningless. And my puzzle that I try and solve in that episode is, why on earth does this very common sense principle, which is really clear when it comes to giving to people, why on earth is that ignored when it comes to giving to institutions?
And I guess there seems like there's a little bit of that Matthew effect going on, right? Like success, we just want to, we want to go with the winner, so we give them more.
Yeah, which makes no sense. I think I actually said in an interview recently that I thought that it was, if you give, anyone who gives money to Princeton, which is on a per capita basis, the wealthiest educational institution in the history of mankind, anyone who gives money to Princeton is committing I think that's a moral obscenity. It's wrong. There's no other way around it. I mean, you know, you might as well just burn your money, you know, if you're going to, it's just a school that is a tiny school with, I don't remember how much money they have in the bank, but on a per capita basis, they are, you know, they're basically, they're like one of those little islands in the South Pacific where everyone's a millionaire.
Right. As you were describing that, it made me think of like stocks, right? And stocks, like the idea is, do you want to, like one of the things you do is you find the stocks that are undervalued and you invest in that. Like people, that makes sense to people. And I think like the schools that are poor or don't have that much money are like sort of the undervalued stocks. There's a lot of opportunity for growth. And then investing world, like you don't want to invest in the company that's overpriced or has already reached its peak price. That's what seems people do with philanthropy.
Yes, that's exactly right. That kind of, it's funny, you know, and so this is another area where in certain realms, I think we think rationally, or at least we tend to think rationally, but then in other areas we don't. So we think rationally about stocks. Usually, but when it comes to educational philanthropy, we're completely unwilling to kind of, or not always, but many people, many wealthy people who are normally very thoughtful and intelligent are unwilling to use their same think as rationally when it comes to their educational giving.
It's interesting. Well, Malcolm, one thing I'd like to talk to, shifting gears here a bit. I think one thing a lot of people don't know about you is that you're an avid runner. In fact, I just learned this.
I am, yes.
2 years ago, you were 50 years old. You ran a 4-minute, 54-second mile, which blows my mind because it takes me like 13 minutes to run a mile. When did you start running? And I'm curious, is there's anything you've learned from running that you apply to your work as a writer?
So I was, I ran a lot in, high school and then, very successfully. And then I stopped and really didn't race again for 30 years. Although I ran a little bit, but I was started to run seriously again in my 50s. Running is about, I don't know whether there's a direct overlap. With writing, except that it gives you a period of time, extended period of time for reflection. And I just think, right, if you're going to be a successful writer, you need to have extended periods of reflection. And so you go for a 10-mile run. That's a good, you know, hour and change where that you have with your, that you're alone with your thoughts. And so that can be there's a nice overlap between the the opportunity given by a long run and the requirements of writing.
Well, Malcolm, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about your work and your new podcast, Revisionist History?
Well, we have a website, revisionisthistory.com, where all the episodes are available for download. And I have a website, gladwell.com, where a lot of my writing is archived. And so I think between the two of those websites, you can pretty much get the full story.
Fantastic. Well, Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Yeah, it's been really fun. Thank you.
My guest today was Malcolm Gladwell. He's the author of several books you can find on Amazon.com. But be sure to check out his new podcast, Revisionist History. You can go to revisionisthistory.com to download episodes there or search for it on iTunes. It's a really great show. Also, check out the show notes for this podcast at aom.is/Gladwell. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this show, have gotten something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes. It helps us out a lot. As always, thank you for continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.